Welcome to Leadership Beyond the Trenches. I'm your host, Anne Reifenstein. And today I'd like to share with you a conversation I had with Chief Warrant Officer Kevin Mathers. Chief Warrant Officer Mathers is the command senior enlisted leader for NATO's Allied Land Command, which is in Izmir, Turkey. He took some time off his leave and had a long conversation with me, sharing his thoughts about leadership. He's a really thoughtful and reflective leader who talks about institutional leadership from the perspective of the senior NCO. He talks about the role of patience, humility, mentoring at the institutional level. You can tell that he's really passionate about this subject. And so here's our conversation on leadership.
Really, the subject itself is really near and dear. Obviously, 35 years in, leadership has always been a topic of conversation since I was a young private. I spent my chief warrant officer time, I spent at the Armored School, and then went to OSID Institute.
OSID Institute is a military academy that's focused on the professional development of non-commissioned members who are called upon to take on institutional jobs. It's a center of excellence in leadership.
Where I did a multiple jobs, the lion's share of my work was as a chief instructor there. So we worked a lot on these similar things that you're talking about today, on virtual learning, distance learning, how to communicate to people in distance learning, really these cognitive capacities and how do you translate all that. So I spent a lot of time doing that. I worked with the Georgian Armed Forces for, as a secondary part of that task, building their Sergeant Major Academy and their Sergeant Major course in particular, as part of a group called the Defense Enhanced Education Program, which was a group of chief warrant officers from across the alliance helping Georgia look closer to the NATO methods of instruction and competency building. So that was my first exposure to NATO in that sense, like personally related. You know, obviously Afghanistan, we were part of a NATO, you know, a NATO group. I worked with other countries peripherally before, but that was the first time that I realized that leadership in NATO means friendships and partnerships and patience. So I learned a lot about that piece and how to communicate prior to coming into this job. So last year, I came into LANCOM here in Izmir, Turkey, where the Land Forces Command is posted, the headquarters is posted. I work alongside a U.S. three-star general, Lieutenant General Klutze right now, who just changed out this summer. He's in since August this summer. So what is that? That title was as much as I understood, I think. I had expectations coming in, but the title was the suggested path I was going to have to follow. So basically, in my head, it was Army Sergeant Major NATO. So I kind of had some preconceived notions of how that would work, and all to learn that it was very different than I'd expected. But it's been a heck of a learning curve. But I've learned a lot of how to do my job better. I thought I had enough skills and understanding to be able to just use it and do it my way, but I had to change my way quite a bit. And so that's kind of background of where we are and where I'm at. I'm a year into the job and a bit now. I came in June of 2019, so a year and a half almost now.
That's quite the journey to get to this point. Can we just talk about some of those changes that you said you had to make?
The changes. One of the things that I, if I could frame it, Canadian military, Canadian leadership, Army leadership in particular, we speak the same language, languages, French and English, but also that military language is very similar. We have similar understandings. Maybe we have to, especially at my level and my time in, the group that I associate with for these big level discussions, generally we don't have to define the topics. There's an accepted and understood definition. And that goes for all kinds of meetings and, you know, planning sessions, whatever it may be. We don't have to spend a lot of time on the opening. We just get to the work because there's a commonality. That's not so much in a NATO environment. Let's not say it's a bad thing. In a NATO environment, the cultural piece has a huge say, a huge vote in what we do. So an average meeting at LANCOM, because we have 23 nations represented in the headquarters, of the 30 in the Alliance. And then we have three partners that are actually with us as well, of the multitude of partners that are out there. And partners are at all different stages. So what does that mean? So that means that in the room, we could have Spanish general, Turkish general, American, obviously the boss, a German general, and a multitude of colonels from, you know, all kinds of flags on their shoulder. So the meetings that would happen in Canada happen similarly in that the outcomes that are desired are very much similar. However, culturally, you have to have a lot more patience. You have to speak a lot slower. You have to make sure that the definitions of what it is you're working on are understood. But again, what I've found in the last year is none of that is a bad idea. That is all things that would definitely benefit a Canadian discussion, because it could take away those sidebar discussions, and it gives you that holistic, completely unfolded problem set prior to working on a solution. So it does take a long time for a room to come up with a consensus on the way forward. But again, I've learned to have that tactical patience in the year I've been here. I have the understanding of where we're going, but what I didn't have is the level of understanding of patience that would be required for a meeting to get somewhere. In the beginning, I found that very difficult to, that Army guy patience that you have to, especially as an NCO, you have this tendency to, once you think you have a handle on the problem, you immediately start forming solutions in your head, which is something that's not, it's not always the best way to do planning, especially at the strategic level here, where we're working with the graduated response forces that fall under us, spread across all of Europe. That's kind of the big picture awareness that I had. The other thing I should add in there is that early on, I discovered that just because someone cannot articulate his point in English that, you know, to the level that I'm used to, does not and should not be confused with a lack of ability or a lack of competence or understanding. It means that he's speaking probably in his third or fourth language. And I have to assume that his career has brought him to this level, particularly at the rank of full colonel or one-star general speaking. As an NCO, I have this bias that I had to get out of the way and say, okay, it's just taking him longer to say it. And the problem is my patience. So I need to listen and try to pick out what it is he's trying to say. So that's big picture lesson learned.
I'm just wondering if there's a guiding philosophy or an approach that you've taken with your leadership that helps you. That
philosophy has been the same. That part is ironically the same as at home. It's get to know the people in the room, spend time knowing their approach, and then it really helps when we're together, because I realize when someone is, the way in which they're describing something, it isn't or may not be arrogance. It just might be the way they communicate, or it may not be submissive or a lack of confidence. It might just be his culture and the way. So I need to get to know how each of, and here in particular, when I say get to know him or her and them, it's the rank level from the country, and then the culture in his group setting here, and the culture from which he comes from and how they communicate. So I think my guiding principle is always an NCO rule, is know your people, know what level of patience is required to be able to hear them, and then let yourself listen and try not to finish sentences and recognize cues from the way I've conducted myself in the past that may offset a conversation. In other words, if I finish somebody's sentences because I think I'm helping him, I may actually be insulting his language ability. So I need to have the patience to sit back and finish his thought, and then let him get to the point that takes a little longer, but it will be just as valid as if I prompted it faster.
As it goes back to, how has your leadership evolved? What have you brought with you from your early days of leading to where you are now?
Absolutely. As I said, I hoped when I got here, I had experienced enough to contribute. And what I quickly learned is everything that's old is not new or forgotten or should be put aside. That early thing in our education shapes how confident you are in sort of the conduct of the group and how the group behaves and where the group is going. those things are absolutely applicable now. But what I did, particularly OSINT Institute, the 3 years I spent with professional military education in OSINT, in Saint-Jean, really, really improved my understanding and just filled my toolbox with these mechanisms and systems to better analyze things and to sort of understand how groups work, how organization behaves, how teams are formed. So that 3 years of really dissecting that and then teaching that and then witnessing it with the students in OSINT and their direction. And as a chief instructor, I was able to shape that. So it was a lot of fun then. And it actually has carried forward into here. I've found that those NCO skills and how to get a troop to work together at even that lowest tactical level, now at strategic level, has a similar effect because groups are groups. Once you understand and analyze and spend the time, you know how to get that group dynamics going the direction in which the commander's intent and vision wants. So you do have to do the work. You have to get to know people. And that has never been any different for my style. As an armored guy, you have to get to know which crews work best together. You have to know what commander, gunner, driver, loader combination will get you the best result. Here, it's which NCO and which division, which nation will have the most preferred outcome for working and getting things done. And then it goes even broader to the nations where I work with a Canadian chief warrant officer in Poland. And then I have a Greek who is of similar time in and experience to myself, who is one of my subordinate chiefs. But then I have a subordinate chief that is a British sergeant major in England, young gun, very hard-charging, confident, competent leader. Then I have a Greek sergeant major they call command senior enlisted in NATO, the Rapid Deployable Corps in Thessaloniki, Greece. He is 32 years old. So the mentoring that has to happen with that group level, again, you go back to the books in the back of your mind and sort of say, okay, what did I do with that young guy? And can I use the same approach? So those are kind of the things that I've brought with me and revisit all the time.
That sounds like a very interesting crew with a lot of, you know, bringing a lot of different things to the table. Well, how would you describe your role as part of a command team in general and then in perhaps specifically in this NATO context? Because you're working with a U.S. general, though we speak the same language, we do have quite different perspectives in certain things. So could you share your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. The role has changed quite a bit from my early days as a chief warrant officer. I'm going on 7 years now. So in the early days, it was teamed with a commander who came from the same background. So, and I happened to know them or knew them and understood a lot of the things that we needed to get done. So the role was much more obvious, I'd say. That tactical level, that first contact as a command team that happens when you're a young fella now applies at the chief warrant officer and lieutenant colonel level. So that first contact is quite a good event to build what it is you want to be as a chief warrant officer, because you got this comfort level and then you tackle wicked problems and come up with ways to use your critical thinking a little better in a comfortable environment. So it's kind of that walk run stage. Now you fast forward that in through, you know, command teams that are quite different and quite diverse. As you move on past the tactical and start to do post-tactical, you're now working with more civilians. You're working with different elements. Your OSINT is a completely joint environment. So it's all branches, all services. So that then molds you and it changes your role. So your role now is, how does the institution want people to lead? How does the institution, not how does the Armored Corps want it? It's what did the Armored Corps teach me that will help the institution broaden the competency of these guys? So that was in that role. Then you fast forward to all of that, then just forms and shapes your style. And then you get to NATO and realize each of the nations has a different approach to how NCOs are empowered or used or employed. They have similar tactical experiences, but the way in which they're invited into the room is quite different. So a role with an American three-star general and a Canadian alongside is it's an amazing opportunity, because the American officer team completely gets the effectiveness of a team that lets NCO roles be introduced and used and empowered, and they quite easily accept your advice, your inputs, your thoughts. And the trick is, the role is to give not just honest and sincere advice, but helpful new perspective, not an officer perspective. I think a lot of us going through the journey, you hit these identity crisis where moments where you think you need more education, or you think you need more of some exposure, because you feel maybe I haven't got everything in the back of my mind that can help this commander. But I will say that a lot of it is the self-development, the self-awareness is as important as the education piece to being a good command team partner. And the trick again is to be a partner that contributes, understands what the nuances of that commander, but then, and what his vision and intent is, and you got to get that as quick as you possibly can. And then your role is to just promulgate that, but then to just to make it operationalize that vision. So that means your role is getting into the room, being prepared to speak on multitude of topics. So you need to always be reading, always be listening, and then sort of absorbing it, and then taking the time and the patience to decide what your thoughts are on that. And avoid the role at this level at NATO is to avoid the knee-jerk reaction or the gut reaction to things, because you've got, it may indeed be the correct response, but you have to be sure, because the role at this level, when there's, you know, 14 other chief warrant officers that are subordinate to me that I'm mentoring, that have cores underneath them, when I say something, it has a response, and things will happen from that. So you have to be careful what you say and what your thoughts are. There is no such thing as a personal thought when you offer something. It becomes LANCOM's, command senior enlisted's opinion, which means that the land forces, in your opinion, think this way. So that's a big, big difference in the role from the tactical level chief warrant officer to the strategic level, is that you have to be careful what you say and to who you say it. That's just making sure that you realize you're responsible for what comes out of your mouth. So that those roles are all similar, but now those basics of the representing the NCOs of the land forces, representing the alliance, everything that you contribute should be towards the betterment of that NCO. So it means when you discover a chief warrant officer in a nation that doesn't empower their chief warrant officers, my job is to champion that carefully, to show them the benefit of allowing that nation, who traditionally hasn't empowered NCOs, what benefit there is if they do it.
I'm going to just take you back to a couple of things that you talked about with empowerment of senior NCOs from nations who perhaps see their non-commissioned members differently, and mentoring. How do you go about that empowerment piece and the mentoring of people who are coming from very different places than you?
The easy answer is be available and be open. So what does that mean? A guy named Bob Provencial taught me way back when I was a young master warrant officer, and I was at the Canadian Forces Training Development Center in Borden, which I thought at the time was a crazy job for me. We have this one combat arms job there where you're the sergeant major of that training and development center. But he taught me about, he's a retired Air Force major, and Bob taught me about listening skills, different types of learning, personality types, everything from Myers-Briggs to the DISC model. And I mentored in Switzerland where for their sergeant major course in CERN Switzerland. I was tasked there to be the senior mentor for that course, which is a NATO course. And so all of those touchy-feely skills and understandings of people and how people act helped me to realize that mentoring for one is not going to be the same for another. You have to understand what it is they need. You have to ask for their permission to give them advice, which was a huge, it seems like a simple thing, but I remember the moment when he said, you have to be invited into the conversation. even if you're identified in a role that has a job. For instance, I am expected to be the mentor and coach for the Sergeant Major of the Rapid Deployable Corps in Thessaloniki. I am expected to do that. So I could choose to tell him what I think he needs, or I could patiently ask him what he thinks he needs. So that approach has really paid off, because it puts the onus on that person, but it also does something that, again, that I learned I did a year at RMC as a student. And I remember I was in a cognitive psychology class, and the teacher used an expression called Socratic dialogue. And I pretended that I knew what that meant, and then I had to look it up. But I'm telling you, that moment of understanding the power in that Socratic dialogue was huge, because here I know what I want him to say, but I have to get him to think he wants to say it, if that makes sense. I got to make him want to do the dishes, you know?
Put a lot of really interesting things in there talking about your soft skills development. I really like that idea of being invited into the conversation when you're in a mentoring position, because even if you are an assigned mentor, it doesn't necessarily mean people are ready or want to hear what you have to say. And you've talked a lot about some of the things that you've done along the way in your career, some of the jobs and some of the education. What do you think were the key things that really prepared you for doing this type of role? You know, was it a particular role model or professional development or some of your experience or education? Would you mind just talking a little bit about that?
The funny thing is, my wife and I talk about it quite a bit, because she's retired Navy, and we taught similar things together. And she and I both agree that it is those soft skills, as you say, that have had the largest impact on my leadership style in the latter decade of my leadership jobs. And the funny thing about that is that it would not have, if you'd asked the 23-year-old Mass Corporal in Calgary, if an experience teaching adult education methods to young instructors would have helped me, I would have said no. Commanding a tank in Afghanistan will definitely is what I need. Parts of that are true at that time, but the last decade, I've tapped into things that the very first course I did in OSID was the Intermediate Leadership Program. That was the switch between when it was the old Senior Leadership course, which was SLC, it made that switch. I remember doing that ILP and thinking at the time as a young warrant officer, quartermaster in an armored recce unit, what in the world will these soft skills, these ways of brainstorming and, that transformational leadership and the understanding of what will that do for me? And I really couldn't see it. The epiphany has been in my time in particular as a chief warrant officer, I have come to this complete realization that journey through those soft skills, through those opportunities, really made me understand how to do a better job at what I could probably do without it. I could have done it and I could do it without that. But man, can you ever do a better job of it with those self-development, those purple experiences? And I mean, maybe purple experiences isn't a transparent term, but for me, those jobs that were outside of my comfort zone, outside of my branch, have really gone a long way to shape me. Taking those jobs and assuming that someone knew that this was a good idea has really paid off. One of my mentors was Mario Belcourt, who was a Francophone at the French regiment in Valcartier. And when he told me in an interview that, listen, you're going to be a chief warrant officer, I'm going to get you on a French course, then I want you in Valcartier. And he was the career manager at the time, and he lived up to what he said he was going to do in a conversation in a brief moment as a career manager. That completely pivoted my, and it really vaulted my advancement, because I did the French course. I did a year long. I spent 4 years. Mario asked me to stay an extra because the standard was do the French course, do 2 years, and then go back to your English unit. I stayed 5 years in total in Valcartier. I was able to not only pick up new styles and new approaches, even though it was the same equipment, but I picked up a second language. I picked up patience. I understood how difficult it is to be in a room full of people speaking another language. And I, as Mario did or didn't do on purpose, put me in someone else's shoes for a while. And that really shaped me and started me thinking different. And that was at a warrant officer level. Luckily, I was able to do all of those courses through the OSID plan. Like, I started at ILP and I finished with the senior appointment program. So I did all of my PME, the professional military education, at OSID. I got to kind of piece together the journey of the PME that we get to do and realize the benefits. And then those key moments, French language course as a young leader at the rank of sergeant was one big moment. If there was two others, one was as a career manager, because then Mario Belcourt, that had brought me to the career shop, because usually it was a Francophone, but he had groomed me to have a language ability to be an English speaker in the armored career shop. So that was the second huge thing, understanding that people are not names on a spreadsheet. Every person's name on that spreadsheet has a family, has a house, has a contact, has a story. And then lastly was my time at OSID as the chief instructor. So kind of like those three pivotal moments kind of along the journey are the probably the biggest impacts that the 20-year-old Kevin in Calgary would not have imagined I would have saw myself, doing everything in the regiment will make me the better person. But I know now that's not the 100% solution.
It's really interesting to hear about your experiences. You know, we're in a remote environment now. I was wondering, how do you translate those soft skills, all those great things that you've learned? How do you make that work in a dispersed or a remote environment?
This is something we've all been talking about, obviously. The lucky thing is, prior to COVID, we're naturally, the way land forces are spread across NATO, we are dispersed. And we can't all be together all the time at all. We have these sort of key moments where we'll convene and discuss and make a plan. That has already been something that's been worked through. And so that challenge was there before COVID. So then we have to use all of the mechanisms we have, all the software, the IT, the link calls, all the social media pieces. WhatsApp is huge to keep in touch here. And it's not something I even knew about before I got here, but that checking in is huge in dispersed leadership. Checking in is, and those are guiding principles for mentorship as well, but they go a long way towards helping leadership. Because I wrote an article in the Land Power magazine. One of my other jobs is we have a magazine comes out twice a year, so I have to have a message. This year, the one that just came out in September, I made the linkages through partnership needs friendship. And that's absolutely can't be false. You literally have to reach out, know when the baby's coming for the guy in Greece, know when the girlfriend's coming to visit the sergeant major that's in Poland, and when boarding school starts for the sergeant major in England. You have to know that. You have to keep those notes. That then bridges the contact. And military is, in my experience anyway, in 35 years, the military is very forgiving as long as you keep in touch. We don't all, you can have best friends in Petawawa that you don't see for 10 years and suddenly you're posted together in Edmonton and you can start where you left off. And so we have that patience and understanding as military members. So you have that luxury. But the trick is you have to say, how is Jen and the kids doing? And you have to know that's correct. And you have to know that's important to that person. So the dispersed leadership just makes your job, it makes it different. It doesn't make it any less sincere. It just means you have to spend time doing the homework and knowing when you haven't talked to a friend in a while. It can't be all business. For dispersed leadership, you got to reach out and spend that time having a conversation. Hey, is Johnny doing soccer again this year? No, he's not able to do it this year because of COVID. Okay, so what are you guys doing? Are you doing homeschooling? How's that working out? You have to have that moment before you say, okay, so now what I need from you. Because otherwise, if you launch in with the what I need from you, you might get it, but you've put a strain on the willingness to cooperate with you and to get to more difficult decision making. So I think that's kind of how we looked at it. And COVID has really created some IT solutions, and we've done a lot more Zooms. We do a lot more VTCs, virtual training, virtual meetings that happen at the headquarters. Have to be thought out, have to be planned, have to get the right audiences together. And so all of that has to be weighed in, but it's just stuff. It's just stuff you have to do. So in many ways, COVID has forced our hand to do and create more solutions, but it's also been a good thing. Now, when we do, though, we still travel, but we do it deliberately. When we do dispersed leadership style now, we've always done things with a gender lens, and you know, and planning lens. Now the one filter that we have to put in is COVID. So it's just another filter that we have to put into our plans. It's just being deliberate and not off the cuff when you do things. But now when you have the face-to-face contact, it's like Thanksgiving every time, because you've been in touch and now you're so happy to see each other. It's created an even stronger tie into your group.
The dispersed and remote leadership creates a stronger tie-in, because a lot of folks are saying that that's the challenge of creating those connections. What's the most satisfying thing that you've done with respect to your leadership role?
I think I thought about this because it was in there as a suggested topic, and my wife and I talk about it quite a bit, like what is success along the way here? And here, I think the biggest moments have been witnessing those that you're helping changing themselves. An example, I'm working extensively with two of our French corps. So one is the Rapid Reaction Corps in Lille, and then we have the other one in Strasbourg, which is the Euro Corps. There's two sergeant majors in there, and we talked about those nations that continue to have very, very competent, aggressive, good NCOs who have difficulty playing the same roles that we're accustomed to. So with that unit in particular, I took it as a project to let's see what I can help with. And we were able to, in this first 6 months, I brought together all, before COVID, I had a command senior enlisted conference for those NATO force structures that are subordinate to us. That group of leaders I brought together in Thessaloniki, Greece, and we worked through their problems. And I managed to get the CCEL out of Eurocorps onto a leadership course. It's a NATO leadership course, a brand new one. Traditionally didn't have a lot. It was more in the Baltic region. So it's at the Baltic Defense College. So when I went to speak at the Baltic Defense College and championed for this guy to get on there as a student, that was my small win I was hoping for. The outcome was he will present it's a 3-month course. He will present his final paper to my new commander. We are now invited to go to the graduation week of that college in Estonia. Really was started with just a qualification and hope that they recognize that's worth it, to turned into somebody who's championing his own cause and taking it off and now creating a system within the French army for that to happen again and again. And to me, that was like a huge win that I never expected. And so that's kind of the one of, there's been lots of great little wins, but similar great wins with the, you know, different unit. The German Netherlands Corps is a really unique dynamic with German commander, a 3-star general, and a Dutch sergeant major who has very similar styles to us from a unionized army and blah, blah, blah. So I've had some great wins with them creating some stuff, but that one with Eurocorps was probably the big moment this year.
It's really cool. It actually ties into the next idea I was hoping we could talk about, is how do you see yourself contributing to the profession of arms in terms of stewardship?
Obviously, the luxury of this position is that, and it is, some will say it's a burden, but I see it as a huge opportunity to dump all that you've got and all that you inherited and all that was handed to you to create a better you. And I mean, it sounds kind of philosophical, but I do think about it in my, you know, this will likely be my last job. And you realize the drums are beating that you won't get to pass that on anymore. So I think for me, that sharing of information, finding that young kid within the unit that you're at, like here at the headquarters, finding that Canadian and that maybe that British sergeant major, it's a little broader than I thought. As far as the profession of arms goes, it's the opportunity is huge here. So you can help a young Spanish sergeant, and you can help a Canadian warrant officer, and you can help a British sergeant major, all at the same, not in the same way, but at the same time as part of the job. So you can ask them to do more, then you can spend the time with them. So those are the places where I can help the young professionals, and then identify talents and ask them to do more and challenge them so that they get those opportunities that, like I got, that they never would have thought of. And so doing that, you then get to, and I have the luxury again, to be able to see the Spanish Army Sergeant Major, who is also connected to us in LANCOM, and let him know, hey, I spotted a sergeant in our headquarters that you should know about, that he otherwise would never know, and then tell him what this guy's doing. With the small group of Canadians, I can shape who's coming in, but I can shape the opportunities here and then reach back home to their career manager, explain to them what that guy's doing. So for me, it's been a people. The human dimension, the human terrain that we have is the best opportunity to shape the profession around. And it's giving those people that chance. Even if it doesn't go the way you hoped it will, it's still a chance that will change them forever, because failure is equally as character building as success. Because in many ways, that callus you build, force marches, the more you do, you'll build up calluses, you'll be able to go further. So you make those mistakes, you do a better job next time, and you're not afraid to tackle things you haven't tackled before. So I think, in my humble opinion of this journey for profession of arms and what all that means, that's a huge piece of it. The human terrain, taking the time to make somebody's life have some trajectory, make them think of things, and then hope that you spend your time making your replacement a better prepared and a better person when he gets there than you were able to do, because we all wish we'd have done more or read more or traveled more or whatever. But the idea is, if you spend all your time building that team and their preparation and their exposure and experiences, then you're doing your job more than you are trying to figure out where you should go or what you should do, because that becomes very self-centered. And if you're self-centered, then you've lost vision on the down and in. If you lose sight of that, you've really lost a chance for an opportunity for influence.
It's interesting that you say that about the human dimension. I think that's a really important factor that doesn't necessarily get considered as often as it should. What's been the most challenging? You talked about how failures and how things, when they don't go well, help you build that callus to allow you to go forward. What's been the most challenging aspect as your role as a leader?
That one for me was really that awareness at the strategic command team level, I think, has been the biggest challenge. So realizing that prior to this, the commanders I've teamed up with are generally a little younger, where my kids are in university and graduating, their kids are, you know, in primary school, because officers did their education up front. So they generally, their life was in a different place. And so in that early tactical leadership, that was the norm. And so you had stuff to offer that the young colonel may not have experienced yet in life in general and in the military and, you know, in the group settings. But as you move along, now, when I got here, I was 53 years old last summer. My commander was 56 years old. He's a 3-star general who led corps in battle in Iraq. His experience, his education, his age, his kids are all grown up in the military. I could no longer fall back on that. Listen to me, young fellow, I've got some things that you should know about life. I had to rethink how we worked as people together. And I had to understand that my advice, my guidance, my suggestions could not be about life experience. It had to be about what we were in. So that was a huge challenge, because that meant that I had to get ahead of the curve and I had to have as equal of an understanding of our strategic picture. And oh, by the way, he was in the job already for a full year. So he was in his second year and quite confident on what was ahead of them and what LANCOM looked like and what NATO standards were, et cetera. So I had to figure out, first of all, what would be the dance, who would lead in this partnership in conversation? When would I back off? When would I have nothing to say? And sometimes it's important to have nothing to say because it isn't value added. So I had to figure that out. So in combination with that challenge was the study and the reading. At the classification levels that we deal with, I had to figure out how to absorb information in a new way, because I was used to taking notes, reflecting, you know, in my experience in education, things I've done, I figure out how. When things are at a security classification level where you can only read them and then shred them or lock them in the safe, and you can only read them in a certain safe place, that changes that whole dynamic. how do I approach that? So those are the big challenges that were related, but not always related, but it definitely that level of knowledge that you needed to take on in a new way.
So are there any traits or any characteristics that you think are of value to have as an institutional leader?
Yeah, that's a good question, because we talk about competency building, and we did a lot with the strategic employment model on leadership profiles. So we spent a lot of time when I was at OSID working with the SEM project, and then working with the Georgians, because we talked a lot about competencies. So I've been around the conversation and thought a lot about it. And I think it's the main thing is to have humility, have vulnerability while you're still confident. So to figure out the times when you need to be tough, because there needs to be a certain level of resilience and, as my dad would say, stick-to-itiveness to get things done. But I think you also have to be honest and humble when things are not in your realm of expertise, without diminishing your capacity to get smart on it. So what I mean by that is, one of the ACOS used to intro every huge description, but he would always start with, "I'm sorry." And I thought, as a Canadian, I used to chuckle to myself, but I realized that in that room, they saw him differently when he repeated that all the time. And he was not humble, but he was trying to say he was humble. And you cannot in an environment like this say something and make it to be true. You've got to be that. So you've got to show vulnerability. If you are trying to say that you don't understand something, you've got to say it in a way that you mean it, but in a way that you think you'll get there, because you have to instill the confidence at the same time. So really, I think that piece of the leadership journey you do on how different people respond, transformational leadership is a huge piece of that, because every soldier has a different response in the way that you get him and influence him or her to do something. So that, I think that awareness, self-awareness, is another big piece of it. And again, a lot of these are not the moment in the tank crew that happens. At least overtly, it doesn't happen. But in time, you start to realize how you can get a crew to do things. Then you just, those abilities to read a room, or to take the time to read a room and understand who is influencing a group and who is speaking when they shouldn't be speaking. That dance is a big piece of whole bunch of capacities and competencies that you have to have. And that emotional intelligence and tact is a huge piece of that. And I would not have gotten that had I not spent time with the professional military education piece, had I not spent time as a student at RMC for a full year as a chief. There was two Army guys, we were there, and it was a huge moment of humility of realizing, my God, these poor 19-year-old kids, the work they're putting in to get through 4 years of university. That year really opened my eyes to a young officer's journey. And so it gave me a chance to have that, you know, that respect. I know that's a whole bunch of different attributes, but I try to give what the things that popped into my head as I work around these subjects in the last couple of years.
There's so much in there. We could have an entire conversation just about all of those attributes. That's really, really thought-provoking. I got to say, because some of the stuff I've talked about in my podcast, but other stuff I haven't really touched on, and particularly and I haven't talked about that with my students. You know, it's funny when we talked about traits, you know, we talked about how important it was for institutional leaders to be charismatic, but at no point did anybody ever say humble or humility. And it's funny, because I talked with in my following conversations with other leaders, they've all mentioned the importance of humility in institutional leadership. So I just want to say thank you so much for doing this with me. It makes a huge difference, I think, for people to be able to hear leaders talk about their journey and how they do business. It's interesting. So thank you. Thanks for the time. I know that you're really busy, and I know that you're on leave.
So, thank you. It's all good. I thank you for taking the time to do this. I think it's huge for us to give back, and it's such a fun topic, and there is no one word answers to most of this stuff. But and I think it's really cool that you're doing it from this angle. And I think it's really cool that it's an officer NCO discussion, because I think we're all in the same community, but so often the paths are dedicated to one or the other.
I got so much from this conversation with Chief Warrant Officer Mathers. Just having him speak about the importance of humility, how he employs patience in his leadership style, and how he communicates with people, building those relationships, building those friendships, building those connections amongst people from a variety of different backgrounds is really something that, you know, most of us as leaders really need to take on board and really look at our own skills doing that. Thanks for joining us on Leadership Beyond the Trenches and the conversation I had with Chief Warrant Officer Mathers. Leadership Beyond the Trenches is hosted and produced by Anne Reifenstein, with music provided by Mikhail Heilman under Creative Commons licensing.